crackers, to the hackers and the crackers. I see in binary, I speak source code. Step on my toes, I'll post a million JPEGs of you in a fag pose. In your digital stance, hitting firewalled hoe. Cause I'm riding the net in my 6-4. I was a dick with my 56. Now with my cable, I'm able to get that stable. On the out, my name is Ace and I'm a Leo. On the digital highway, my name is Neo and I'm a hero. In a flash, I'll school you on burning Dreamcast. You need some ISOs? Let me through my hard drive rifle. Our exchange you could never stifle. In a digital hug, you just caught the love bug. I bootlegged your CD. I caused the fight between Un and Jay-Z. You see, G, it's all gonna be free. Whether we take it by force or we take it nicely. You feel that rattle in your bones? When I tell you we just hacked Dow Jones. And NASDAQ leave you flat on your back. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers. Serial codes, source codes, ISOs, RANs, SIPs, SIPs. Dedicated to the hackers and the crackers.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Binary Revolution Radio numero 98. Number 98. Episode 98 coming to you on May 31st, 2005. And some of you who have been listening for a while probably recognize that little voice you just heard, our returning co-host this week, a long-time returning co-host, the original co-host, actually, Wintermute, is with us this week.
It's not really a little voice. It's pretty booming voice. As Duel would say, it was a radio voice.
Radio voice,
little.
Exactly.
It's not little.
So, we are going to talk about some cool stuff today. Wintermute's going to talk about some ham radio topics that he's been working on lately, and hopefully bring me up to speed at least a little bit. I'm sure not completely. I'll see if I can follow along as best I can. But before we do that, let's take care of a little housekeeping here at the beginning of the show. Actually, there's only one thing I really wanted to talk about, and that is Freak Factor. Freak Factor Episode 5. If you haven't been listening to Freak Factor, that is our new hacking freaking reality radio show. You can check out freakfactor.net. That's freakfactor.net. For more information, to download some of the other episodes, et cetera, et cetera. It's been much more successful than I ever thought it would be. We did it just because it was new, never been done before. We wanted to see if we could do it, and kind of a fun idea. And it really has been kind of a fun show. This past week particularly, I guess some people didn't care for it, but others seemed to had a lot of fun with it. And Episode 5 actually had the highest ratings, as it were. Not that there's, like, ratings exactly, but probably the most activity that we've ever had on any episode. So considering we're only 5 weeks in to an experimental show that has no set format, no particular way of doing things, it's completely random and chaotic, I think it's coming along pretty good. We had upwards of 75, 76 people in the IRC channel and active and talking and chatting, which is very cool, in #BinRev on Dalnet. We also had, I believe I saw it as high as 54, 55 listeners to the stream. So we're getting a lot of people listening. I mean, we're eating some bandwidth on that show, that's for sure. So we had about 54 people listening, at least when I checked. And, of course, I was kind of in and out, walking back and forth, so I wasn't constantly monitoring it. So I don't know how high it may have actually gotten. I might have to go back and check some stats for that. But it is higher than even the first episode, the premiere episode. So the show is getting some attention. People are finding it fun and interesting. So hopefully you are one of them. And if not, again, check out freakfactor.net and not only listen, but join in and participate. So, unless you had some house... Actually, you know what? I'm going to put you on the spot here for housekeeping. I didn't ask you this earlier, but is Wintermute ones and threes, of course... .net still up and running these days?
It is. It's a little taken down. I haven't done anything because I was planning on doing something over a break. If you go there now, it's going to be just a, kind of a title page that doesn't have anything. It says November 15th on it because I thought I was going to fix it on November 15th, but school got the better of me and I just kind of let it be. I'm thinking about it. I got some material I could definitely put up there now, so I'm thinking, I mean, if I find some time, I have a 40-hour work week nowadays, so we can see, but It's still up. I still own it. It's the only website I own right now, anyways.
And you've been renewing it and whatnot?
Yeah. I renew. I do some other websites, some other private ones, but I still keep that one because I like the name. Actually, someone is trying to sell winterview.com. They didn't ask me for it. They just put up an ad for it, which is pretty funny.
Well, that was awful nice of them. All right. Well, then I guess at this point we should probably jump into the email. Alrighty, so our email this week is, actually this is one of the lightest weeks for email that I think we've ever had, even since the first episode. We did not have a whole lot of email this week, but the ones we got were pretty good. And actually, before I go into a specific one, I got my very first piece of Gmail spam. Have you gotten any spam on your Gmail account?
Never. I have been so impressed. I only get those little, you know, those little ads on the side, but those don't really matter. I mean, I've never gotten a physical piece of spam. It's beautiful.
Right. The ads on the side, you know, you accepted that when you created the account and all that, so you don't really, you have to get those. But, yeah, I'd never gotten an actual piece of spam until today, tonight, I should say. And this is, we're recording this Monday night, by the way. So I just got a piece of spam for the first time, one piece, and it was filtered. Don't get me wrong. It wasn't in my inbox. It went to the spam folder. So first one that I had ever seen, which I thought was kind of a landmark achievement, I guess. I guess now that people have figured out how to get in there, then maybe it's a matter of time. So start before it starts getting flooded. I sent the person who the spam came from, I actually sent them a Gmail invite in response. I thought, you know, kind of be nice and invite them to Gmail, but it bounced back. Big surprise.
Thanks.
But, hey, I tried. I got 49 left. All right, so first email this week comes from DaBeeve from over at Telefreak. And DaBeeve says, "Hello, as normal, great show. I was sitting here writing code and listening to episode 97. A person wrote in about OpenVMS programming, DCL, and general safe programming. DCL actually stands for Digital Command Language. I thought we actually mentioned that on the show, but okay. For the most part, you're correct about its usage. It mostly used as a scripting type of language. Right. You can also use it for submitting batch jobs and such. What makes it more like a, quote, real programming language is the use of lexicals. Lexicals allow you to obtain information, to obtain information about the process, the system, and devices. It also allows you to manipulate data types and strings. This allows you, with DCL, to create real, quote, real programs, for example, CGIs. And that is a good example. About the security of OpenVMS, you're correct that OpenVMS has a bit of an advantage with its security through obscurity, which I mentioned last week that it's just one of those things that not many people know about. Now, of course, I'm not saying that that's a good form of security, and like I said last week, it is a bonus that not many people know what OS you're using. And I said the same thing about Plan 9 from Bell Labs. Plan 9 is another OS that not many people know about, so it's going to be more difficult to hack for the simple security through obscurity factor of it. Anyway, let's see. This doesn't change the fact that VMS is actually a very secure operating system. Things were thought out in VMS a decade before it hit the Nix world. For example, clustering and system fine-grained security controls, or ACLs, checking for overflow conditions, etc. I've been offering people a chance to hack on my cluster for over 4 years now. The result has been a few security problems in third-party software, the WASD web server, for example. It's not been through lack of trying, I assure you. We have yet to see a core OpenVMS exploit. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that they don't exist. I'm certainly not saying that they don't exist. We've had people like, yeah, I apologize if I don't pronounce this, Jean-Loup Gailey, the author of GZIP, who wrote the assembly backend for crack to handle sysuaf.dat files. Even Kevin Mitnick show up in the cluster. Jean-Loup was able to create an exploit for the WASD web server. On the secure programming side, OpenVMS helps you out a bit with that. Typically, things like buffer overruns are caused by unsafe programming practices. And this is kind of changing a little bit of topics. One of the other things we talked about last week also was someone had questioned safe programming practices, and he's addressing that in regards to VMS. The same can even happen with VMS. OpenVMS helps with secure programming with things like descriptors. Without going through the descriptor mechanism, the user application can't use a privileged operation, access a privileged resource, or change the system kernel or other user memory. Dynamic descriptors, where the user can set the buffer size, the system attempts to allocate the space. If for some reason it cannot, the user gets an exception fault. Trying to write beyond the allocated buffer size into system, kernel, or another user's memory, you'll get an exception fault. Many of the OpenVMS privilege service, for example, sort of like running a SUID program in Nix, use static descriptors in which the buffer size is fixed and controlled by OpenVMS privileged code. The user application has no influence over the buffer size in this case. There are things now in the Nix world that emulate the same ideas, but with technically different approaches. For example, OpenBSD, non-executable stack, and libraries like LibSafe. Anyways, I'll stop ranting on. As I said, great show, and a big fat howdy to Natus. Okay, thank you to B for the email. That was a lot of good insight into VMS. Thank you very much for sharing that with us and confirming a lot of the stuff we talked about last week. DCL, controller, any kind of control language, not only DCL, but any kind of control language, all act very similarly to what we've described in the past couple of episodes, whether it's mainframe, whether it's VMS, whether it's AS400, whatever, they all act very, very similarly. Wow. Say that for me.
Similarly.
Oh, gosh, I'm the worst radio host ever. All right, so make sure...
No, that would be dual.
Oh, I forgot about him. Yeah, woo, I'm one step above that, thank goodness. Woo! Oh, he'll never hear this to yell at me anyway. Dual is long unplugged, although I just spoke to him a couple days ago. He's doing well. I pass on well wishes from people to him sometimes, and he appreciates it. So check out deathrow.viztech.net. That's deathrow.viztech.net. And check out their VMS cluster. Create an account. You can get some VMS experience on that. Very cool. Plus, I love the naming convention. It's called Death Row for a reason. I think if you check out the node names, you'll figure out why fairly quickly. Do you use VMS at all?
I used to. When Hackerman was around and I heard about it then, I made a couple accounts, played around a little bit. It was pretty cool. It's very structured, very not rigid. I would say I don't know how to explain it. It's very structured. It's a very structured operating system, I think.
Yeah, I would say rigid is a good word also, but
I don't want to sound like it's it's controlling. It's open. Of course, it's an open. It's called open VMS for a reason. But I mean, it keeps you in check. Basically, it doesn't let you do as much, or get away with a lot of errors. It's very. I don't know the right word. Rigid would be a good word, I guess.
Yeah, and your experience with it was also online here, playing with it.
It was this exact cluster. It's a great cluster. Actually, they run a lot of very useful tools on it. Just kind of. Nice little quirks, nice little things, bulletin board systems, and really very solid stuff. I was pretty impressed.
Yeah, it's definitely a good service. And anybody that's offering, like we've talked about also on past shows, like there's some people out there that offer AS400 shells, which is very cool, and obviously now OpenVMS shells, which is he's been doing this for 4 years plus 4+ years, which is very cool. I love the fact that people are doing this because it. I know there's probably not a lot of people taking advantage of it, or there's not as many as should be, I guess, in my opinion, or there's not as many people find it as interesting as I do, but I do. I think it's great. I have some VMS experience. It's been 15-plus years since I've really played around with it too much, but I still hop on and can move and navigate around somewhat. I don't think I can get on there. He's saying that no one's really... I don't know if he came out and said hack the system, but basically nobody's really found any big, big security problems in it. And I'm certainly not going to be the first. I can tell you that. That's not going to be the case. But
one of the nice things with VMS is there's a great help system in there. It's better than man pages almost.
You can
find really anything you need very quickly if you don't know how to do a command. All the core stuff is actually built into the help. And I'm assuming the third-party things adapt very nicely to it, but it has got a great help system.
Right, and threaded, if I remember correctly, so that it's very easy to start narrowing it down. So, yeah, that's a very good thing to mention as well. All right, so let's see here. That was a great email to start the show with. Again, thanks again to the Beef for that. Dubbeef. Okay, next email this week comes from someone who I'm going to withhold their real name, who says, I noticed that you're able to make the account last for an indefinite amount of time by modifying the source code. He's referring to willhackforfood.biz was in the subject line. Willhackforfood.biz, of course, is our disposable email project that will allow you to put a temporary email account for X number of hours or days if you want to get some information or register for a site but you don't want to get spammed. In the process, you can use these accounts for that type of activity while still maintaining some level of security. And this gentleman seems to think that you can make it unlimited, but that is not the case. It may look like that at first if you try to, I mean, like anything else, it's got parameters that are being passed, the get, post, etc., you can replace anything you want in there, just like anything else. And I think Bland Inquisitor wrote a really good article about this a couple years back about how this could be abused with like a lot of shopping carts and online shopping systems back in the day, where you could change in that amount, and if they don't have any bounce checking on the back end, it might go through. Well, we do have bounce checking on the input fields. You can put it in there when you actually submit. You can change it to whatever you want. But as soon as it tries to create an account, it's going to give you an error message saying that it's outside of the allowed boundaries, which of the maximum you can put in is 7 days. And it's counted actually by hours, if you want to get very technical of how it works, but it's counted out by hours. So 7 days is the maximum that we allow people to set it up. So, yeah, it may have looked like it worked, but if you would have actually gone all the way through, you would have realized that it would stop you before it would create the account. But thanks for playing, and we've got some parting gifts for you. No, we don't, actually. But it was pretty cool that you gave it a shot, so I give you credit for that. Now, let's see. Next email this week comes from Booter. Booter says, hey, Stank, I just recently hacked, in quotation marks, I recently hacked a bar machine / game. Those are those machines you see sitting in bars that have games on them like golf and trivia. I noticed that by clicking on the menu / info button that it prompts you with three choices. I chose the one with stars. Turns out this is a password prompt consisting of a 4-digit code using numbers 1 through 6. I know it can be cracked by social engineering, of course, getting the password from someone, right? But I was determined to do the groundwork. I created a spreadsheet and listed all possible solutions. I then went to work on the machine. Think war dialing. Well, no, there's a better term than that. Think brute force. That's what you're doing. You're brute forcing it. I finally cracked it, and although there isn't too much to do with the system, it was still interesting and intriguing to actually accomplish my mission. Yeah, I mean, brute force is awesome. I still love brute forcing things. I mean, I know encryption is around, and some things you can't brute force anymore. They've made it with proper application of encryption techniques. You can't really brute force a lot of things as easily or as effectively anymore. But stuff like this absolutely can. And just the simple fact that you wanted to. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you could have tried to SE it out of somebody, get the password from somewhere, look it up online, see if it was on default, whatever. Just the simple fact you didn't want to do that. You wanted to see if you could hammer away at it. So I think that's very cool. It's not just brute force, but a little bit of logic in there, right? I mean, Wintermute, we can eliminate some combinations through logic, through simple logic. If we know it's only numbers 1 through 6, you know, we don't have to include anything 7, 8, 9 in there at all.
it's called math, really. It's all, if you take a if you take any type of upper level probability course in mathematics, of course, you can really narrow that stuff down quickly.
Exactly. And I want some of my favorite college courses of all time were probability, which they may call it different. I've never seen it called probability, but you can take some of the higher level statistics courses contain probability. Advanced statistics, quantitative methods of business, some of the higher math classes, and or they may be listed with accounting / statistics, possibly. But those are very interesting classes, and once you take one, you'll never gamble again in your entire life. You'll never ever want to gamble for the rest of your life. Even I had a great teacher. I was very happy with the teacher I had for QMB, where he used gambling as examples for a lot of it, as application for a lot of it. And not only did he show you how it was rigged and how it was always weighted against you, but also, you know, the actual application is to calculate the exact odds and the exact probabilities of certain things. So you, not only did you know it was against you, which logic may dictate that, everybody knows that the odds are in favor of the house, but when you can sit down and calculate it and see how much they're in favor of the house, it really, really opens your eyes a lot. And you can sit down and, based on a little bit of information, figure out which games give the best and worst chances, and which ones you actually have some shots at winning money at in the short term. In the long term, none of them. But anyway, I digress. Those are some of the most interesting classes I've ever had, and I've always emphasized, I wrote that article, Hacking the Lottery, explaining how the lottery works and what a big ripoff, what a big joke that was. And that was definitely inspired by those classes. It's definitely important that anybody in the computer field have a very strong mathematic background. Please, that's just my opinion. And maybe because I just enjoy math. I really, if I had not gone to CIS major, I might have actually become a math major, but I don't know. We'll see. Maybe I'll go back to school again soon. All right. So, yeah, I'm glad to see that you actually cracked it, which is very cool. So, there was an article, it seems like, in 2600. Do you still get 2600, by the way? You still read it, or what?
I read it.
You have time?
It's not sold around here, actually. Not sold at the bookstore, but, yeah, I still read it.
It seems like there was an article sometime in the past year of somebody that had put together like this giant, it was basically one big number. Like what he had sent us, and I will put this up on the notes. But he sent
us... Yeah, it was a one big number about you could dial it, and then you could dial through all of the different codes through answering machines. So like if you're war dialing, you could just dial this one, like, 20 or 30 digit long number, or it was longer, I don't know, and you get through all of it. There's a similar technique used in cracking simplex locks. If you don't know what a simplex lock is,
right,
you can search for it. It's a lock that's a door lock, and it just there's a 5 buttons on it, labeled 1 through 5, and they take different combinations of numbers. It's been around for a long time. It's for doors that are publicly accessible, but you know, it's not, you don't need a key because a key is hard to copy, and it's hard to get people keys. It's hard to change the key lock, but a simplex lock is easy. It's easy to reprogram, and it's just a number. It's a very easy number to memorize. It can be of any length. It can be a couple numbers. It can be 10 numbers or whatever, but it's very easy to go through a lot. There's a string of numbers to push. I've never used it. I don't even have it. I've just heard about it, that you can get through a lot of the simple codes very quickly.
Yeah, and actually some of those... You know, that's one of those things that once they put it on a room, once they've got that simplex lock or whatever brand lock they put on there, they don't go back and change it very often. So, again, that's something where you might SE the, or shoulder surf, even better yet, shoulder surf the password from somebody. But the newer ones are actually gotten very interesting. The newer ones have an interface so you can plug a laptop in there. And I actually was going to look into this and see what I could find out, and it's one of those projects I haven't had time to do. But you could plug a laptop in there, and I believe that you have proprietary software that will connect, and you can actually program people's names in there, because a lot of them now will let you swipe a card or punch in a number. So they have an interface where you can load in a data file with a list of approved people on there and connect and change the password and things. I'm not sure what all the features are. So some of the new ones are more robust. And also, keep in mind that they're not always one-digit numbers. They may go 1 through 5, but you can hold down 1 and 2, or 1 and 4, or 4 and 3. So that adds a lot more combinations.
So a lot of doors around here are two and a 1, like two numbers at once and then one number, or 5, or a string of 5 or 6. I mean, it's up to the discretion of whoever runs the door.
Right.
And there a lot of older ones. I haven't seen any of those new ones. I've been seeing a lot of where I work sometimes. My boss has to, do a little biometric to get in because of the security of the room. But, he told me that those things aren't even foolproof. They're not that high-end because he's had people, not twins, but even, like, cousins or people being able to get through the door. So, it's not, a lot of the stuff is not high-end. It's not, like, government issue.
Right, of course. And, of course, if they have proper physical security, they'll have cameras in place and things like that anyway. But that's a whole nother topic. So, Booter, thank you very much for the email. And I will put up the spreadsheet that he sent me, which is where he had done some of his work on a spreadsheet, which is kind of interesting. And I will throw that up somewhere on the site. I'll put it in the show notes, unless he objects. And I've already stripped out the metadata. Be careful of any Microsoft Office stuff that you send around. It keeps a lot of metadata with company name, author name, things like that. So I stripped that out, and I will throw it up whenever I get around to putting the show notes up for this episode. And I think that's it. And just, you know what, and generally speaking, I know that kind of is a brute force attack. It's not exactly the most high tech and some new technique or anything like that. But you know what, it's still fun sometimes. And it's still fun to just find something you don't know anything about and just challenge yourself to do it. There's nothing wrong with brute forcing. It's all about finding something that you want to play with and hammering away at it, figuring out how it works by whatever means necessary. That's fun. That's what makes hacking fun. And kudos to you, Booter. I don't care, if it doesn't have to be the most elegant new breakthrough zero-day leet exploit, whatever. Hacking's about having fun, and it sounds like you had fun, and I had fun reading it, so kudos to you. And our last email, speaking of default, somewhat. I wonder what the default is for those Simplex, by the way.
I don't know the default, but they're just, people can make them really easy to memorize or something.
Default. All right, our last email comes from SMES, who says, "Hey, Stankdog and Wintermute. I am sure that you are all familiar with the Enigma machine used in World War II by the Germans." And yes, actually, if you're not familiar with it, you might want to go back and listen to OMG. I don't remember the episode with Alanka. We had Alanka on to talk about cryptography, and she mentioned that along with a lot of other great stuff. And, of course, you can search for it and probably find a lot of information. But anyway, the Enigma machine used by World War II by the Germans. It was their cutting-edge cryptographic device that for a while was deemed to be, quote, uncrackable. That's like the hacker's favorite word, by the way. Oh, I'm sorry, behind porn. It was not until Alan Turing came along, and built his binary computer that the Enigma code was deciphered. However, some German Enigma operators simply left the machine's alphabetic code gears on the default setting of, quote, AAA or XYZ, and left them set to the duration of the war. Post-war, it was discovered that if the operators had changed the code set like they were supposed to do, the Enigma machine's code would have been impossible to crack. It's just another example of people, in this case the Axis powers, getting owned by leaving their technology set on the default settings. And yes, SMES, you are correct that everything, and I mean everything, is always on default.
It's also amazing how, not just the fact that they left them on default, but how amazing it was if you go back to the history of the Enigma machine, about how they actually broke it, because it was a bunch of mathematicians over in London. I'll just give a quick synopsis, so it won't take a lot of time.
No, go ahead.
Over in I think it was called Bletchley Park, and they would just sit in this. They would just sit there, and then they would look at the strings of code, and they would read them, think about them, And then there was one guy that I don't think it was turning. I think it was he had a different. Maybe it was turning. It was maybe. I'm not sure. But it was a guy. He basically made a machine that would mimic the Enigma machine because they had, I think they had just some basic knowledge about it. It would mirror it, so he could re-gear it as much as he wanted. And if you read about the Enigma machine, it was an amazing device. I mean, it was so simple, yet so complex about how it would reorganize the alphabet. But he was able to make his own kind of test machine before they actually got a machine. I think during the war they did steal one. But he was able to basically, as soon as a new code came out or as soon as the one he couldn't translate came out, he would start working on it and get it. But then he did notice that the code, some of these codes never changed. So it became easier and easier to fix the machine because they could pick out a lot of the German and rewrite it. So it was an amazing job they did. So read about it. I'm giving a very bad translation of what happened, but,
yeah, but
definitely read about it.
It is a great story, and probably it's just, that's just a cool name to me, the Enigma machine. That is just so mysterious and just such a cool, foreboding sounding. I don't know. I just love the sound of saying Enigma machine. And it's just further proof, and like he says, it's just further proof that leaving anything on default will get you pwned over and over and over again. I mean, you are basically giving one key up by leaving something on default. And one key ciphers aren't effective. They're just not. That's no more difficult than the little Orphan Annie decoder wheel, or, you know? Well, it's a little more. It's a little bit worse than that.
It's just if you don't. It's like leaving key. You know, it's like not changing the key on your web.
Right. So let's close up the mailbag now, I think, and let's move on to our show and tell portion of the show. And we can't do. Let's see. I'll go ahead and start off because you're going to have to do show and tell all the way back to episode 26 last time you were on, and that might take a while.
Yeah.
Is that you leaving a message on my cell phone?
Let's see. Nope.
Maybe it's crime hitting the internet again. Hold on, let me see. Oh, no, it's sports crap. Okay. Let's see. Me, I've got a short one. I got some pretty cool stuff in the mail today. I got a copy of SQL Server 2005 Preview Edition, which gives me, interestingly enough, first of all, it's a DVD, which is cool. So it's a big piece of software. It's Developer Edition. It is 365-day evaluation, and it's 32-bit only. So this is 1 year, so that's good evaluation there. No more of this 30-day crap, 30-day, 60-day, and whatnot. So I'm looking forward to playing with that. As a matter of fact, I might jump on that. I just got it today as we record. I might be using it by the time you hear this show Tuesday. So I also got in some beta 2s of Visual Studio 2005. And I'll probably play around with those soon as well, but I'm definitely looking forward to playing with the SQL Server 2005. And actually, Not Theory and I had a good little discussion about this earlier in the week because he was working on a project in SQL Server 2000, of course, which is the last time. This is 2005, and SQL Server 2000, it's a little old now, it's a little long in the tooth. And we were talking about some functionality he needed that unfortunately was not supported or not built into SQL Server 2000. So, kind of was mentioning that I'm hoping or I'm thinking it might be in the new 2005 version. Now I can confirm and verify that. But, you know, he made an excellent point of how is it that open source software, particularly Postgres, how is it that open source software and open source databases are out there that are more advanced than Microsoft SQL Server 2000, a very expensive product used in production facilities all over the world. But it's behind open source software. Ah, it's amazing. But anyway, that's my show and tell. I'm going to be playing with that. And I actually spent some me time this week. I spent some time doing some other stuff non-tech related. You got to do that once in a while. After Freak Factor, I went out Sunday and did a little drift fishing, a little deep sea fishing. I didn't catch jack squat, crappy fish, but it was a good time out on the ocean, so I kind of unplugged for a day or two, and always good to do that. Definitely don't get stuck in front of the computer 24/7. Even hackers have their limits. You got to go get some fresh air and some exercise and and that kind of good stuff. And that's something that Duel always would say a lot, and in memory of Duel, on behalf of Duel, I'm saying go out there and skateboard is what he was into, go fishing, that's what I like to do, go to the beach, go to do whatever it is that interests you. Don't sit indoors all the time. Go out and do something. Be active. I was momentarily possessed by Duel Parallel. What can I tell you? So how about you? What do you got for show and tell? You don't really have to go back to the 26. You can just talk about what you're working on right now or what interests you right now.
Oh, well, I mean, as a lot of people know, I haven't been on anything for a while, and there's reasons for that, personal and public reasons. I mean, I'm at college. I was just finished my first year, freshman year of engineering over at Notre Dame, and it's been great. It's been a lot of fun. I've met a lot of great people. I've had, you know, just, I mean, amazing time just learning all this stuff. I mean, I took my basic engineering classes, but I also had to take, as a requisite, I had to take a biochemistry class, and I love that class. I really might want to pursue that as I go on. Right now I'm actually working for Notre Dame, rewriting some classes and counseling a camp, but the same camp I counseled, you know, or same camp I was at, which we began everything, you know, so long ago.
You know what? That's a good point. Actually, maybe it wasn't the first episode, but one of the early episodes you did live on a payphone, I think.
Yeah, it was live well, it wasn't a payphone, it was a real phone.
Oh, okay.
His payphone sounded like crap. No, we did it out of there. That was like the first show, I think, about 2 years ago, this summer. It must have been this summer.
Oh, yeah, it had to have been.
This day tour this summer, it was great. And I'm coming back to counselor it, so yeah. And I've just been working on ham radio stuff, which I'll talk about in a minute.
Well, actually, let's go ahead and transition to that now, because that is our main topic for this episode, and that is kind of, see, the thing, and I've said this before, and actually, I feel really bad here, because I think last time you were on the show, I had said back then that I was going to start studying to get my ham license, and I still haven't. So maybe you're going to motivate me to buckle down and go. I actually was motivated enough to try to find a local ham club in my area, but it was one of those dead clubs that nobody goes to, that it still officially existed, but they didn't meet, they didn't do anything, they didn't provide any, you know, there was no place to take the exam. It was like, it was just a dead scene, so I was pretty much on my own, so that's pretty much the position I am still in. So,
you'll
motivate me.
I can bring some news, I can bring some fire, I can light the fire under your ass.
Alright, you do that, you re-motivate me, and,
okay.
And the listeners to ham radio.
Okay, well, here comes my rant. If you just listen for now, it's going to be a lot of me, because I want to go off on a lot of things I've been doing. So for those that haven't heard the previous shows, amateur radio, and that's kind of my thing outside of, you know, hacking or that whole genre. But amateur radio, it's basically, it's like just like broadcast radio, except amateur radio, or, you know, anyone can do it as long as they pass a test. You don't broadcast, you just transmit and you talk to people around the world. Like, think shortwave radio, but, you know, normal people doing it, not big companies. I know the WBAI, the station that runs Off the Hook and Off the Wall, I think they also do Off the Wall.
Right.
They transmit over shortwave and tons of broadcasts. If you get a shortwave radio at, you know, Radio Shack or a flea market, you're going to have a ton of fun with it. I just search online for shortwave, you'll find a ton of stuff. But amateur radio is another one of those things I really enjoy, because it's really together with what I want to do with the rest of my life, being electrical engineering and everything. But at college, where I am at, amateur radio is pretty big, and I'm helping the guys out working and making there's a club here, and I'm helping those guys out, you know, start to get it going and everything. That's a ton of fun. You know, about a year ago, just before I went to college, I passed my general. There's three tests for amateur radio. There's the tech license, the general license, and then the amateur extra license. And I passed my general license beginning of college. That's the one that requires the Morse code. That's sometimes a stumbling block for people, but that might be going away soon. There's talk about removing that. A lot of countries right now don't require Morse code anymore, so America might be going that direction too.
Wow.
So you know, watch out for that. Eventually, you know, it will be going away. I mean, a lot of countries that I can't list off the top of my head, a lot of them don't have the requirement anymore, or they really make it easy. Like, only in America, it's 5 words a minute copy, and I only was through half the alphabet, and I could do it 100%. I mean, not 100%, but well enough to pass. So don't think of it as a hard thing. I mean, if you focus on it for a few weeks, you could definitely pass the test. It's more about the written parts of the test. They're all multiple choice, and all the questions are available online, and there's a lot of websites that I could put in show notes or show notes later on that I can give you links to.
Right,
that will
definitely
help you at 100%, and books and everything. I mean, there's a lot of people out there that want you to pass, and it's once you get on it, you'll never go away. I mean, as long as you find, you'll find your niche on amateur radio, and you'll love it. So right now, I'm actually prepping for the amateur extra, the final test. It's a longer test than the first two. It's about 50 questions, and it's a lot more theory. It's actually kind of funny. The stuff that's in it that you have to learn is what I'm going to be learning about next year in college, so it's not hard stuff. The questions are all the same. Remember, the questions don't change. So you know the answers ahead of time. But then again, on the other side of it, there's a very large question pool. So once you learn it, I mean, you'll have it for the time for the test. So don't worry about that. And the first test is really very easy. It's very, very basic. There's 35 questions. You need to get a D on it, or about 60 or 70% on it to pass. And don't worry about it. Once you got it, you're all set.
Now, how long does that last? Do they retest you every year, every 5 years,
no,
or ever?
It's actually like 10 years, I believe. It's
10.
Very long.
Okay.
They don't really care that much. I mean, unless you break the law, then they revoke your license.
Right,
And they fine you. I've read a lot of reports about people being fined a lot of money. I mean, the one thing people have said is if you're going to get into amateur radio, don't do pirate radio or anything, because if you get caught doing pirate radio and you have an amateur radio license, you're going to get in big trouble. So, I mean, if radio is your thing and you want to be legit about it, or make it, you know, your life, you want to dedicate something and make it a real hobby, then, you know, stick being legal. I mean, there's a lot of people in it that do gray area things, which is okay, but, you know, don't go at a kilowatt out of your trunk, you know, transmitting over some big broadcast radio station, or you will get caught.
Right, and there is actually a lot of emphasis when I was studying some of this. There's a lot of emphasis on ethics.
Yeah, there's a lot of ethics and a lot of things. There's a lot of safety issues too. There's a whole entire sections of the test on safety issues about how much power am I allowed to have, and they're very strict about it. But they do give you a lot of freedom as long as you stay within those bounds.
Right.
And you can bend. I mean, there's a lot of bending to it, which you'll find out once you get into it. If you get into it seriously enough, you will get into a lot of the cooler aspects that aren't exactly, you know, exactly the best or the right things to do. But, you know, you'll have a lot of fun. So I'll go on. Last weekend, if anyone, this is actually a very big swap meet. It's called the Dayton Ham Fest, or the Dayton Hamvention. They call it the Mecca of Ham Fests. A Ham Fest is like a swap meet for technical amateur radio or computer stuff. It's becoming very broad nowadays. I went there 2 years ago with a friend of mine, and I loved every second of it. I mean, you just think, like, if you just look out into the sea of flea marketers, there's a main kind of place for real retail to go along and real businesses to come in, and, you know, the real radio makers show off their new products. But then there's the whole entire parking lot, which is filled with just junk. I mean, it was like, think of, like, if you could condense all of the crap you have, like, everyone, all the listeners have in their house, and put it into one parking lot, and that you just, and then multiply by times 10, because it's insane. And, I mean, I saw everything there. Things I saw, I met a lot of good people. I met the president of the Amateur Radio Relay League, ARRL. They kind of run, they're kind of the voice. Some people don't consider them a good voice, but they're a voice for amateur radio. It's just a club that people join and, you know, you donate money to, but they're always kind of active in lobbying things for amateur radio.
Right.
And funny enough, I saw Emmanuel Goldstein there, and I talked to him for about a minute.
Yeah, I think quite a few of the 2,600 guys, for lack of a better word, 2,600 people, I thought quite a few of them actually go to that.
Yeah, Bernie S., if you go back, way back, into some old off-the-hooks, there's, I think, actually, if Route Secura, I haven't been there in a while, but Route Secura has some recordings of them talking about it. It's pretty interesting. But go, you know, Nick, go over to Nate, seen it, pimp RouteSecura.net, go over there, great site.
Right.
But he's got some, if you go to his MP3s or audio recordings, he'll talk about that. It's very funny. Just running into them is pretty funny. And then I also, I mean, when you go to Dayton, you plan on spending a lot of money usually. Usually crack under the pressure of all the junk that you don't have and you need to have.
Right, but it's not necessarily expensive. I mean, it's actually pretty reasonable, cheap-priced items that are out there, right? It's just that you want so much of it.
There's a lot of things. If you have the patience and you know what you're looking for, you can find it cheap enough. I mean, a lot of people jack price. I mean, I bought a lot of stuff retail. I mean, I bought this new radio, I bought retail because I didn't find it out there. I just kind of cracked under the pressure, but I mean, yeah. If you look hard enough, you'll find what you want out there. I mean, I didn't have that kind of patience, and I didn't see the radio out there anyway. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff there very cheap.
Right.
So I mean, you just got to look around the flea market. I mean, I didn't trust some of those people, but I mean, that's just kind of implicit. You don't really immediately trust a guy in the flea market unless you know how to fix something that they broke, or you would go retail more than outside. So, I mean. That's how I went, but I mean, I bought a brand new radio, an ICOM W32A. I modded it in about 5 seconds. It was really funny. It's modification for those that don't know what these terms. I mean, modification where you open it up to do more than it was supposed to. And if you read online, one great site for mods that I always talk about is mods, mods.dk, mods.dk. It's a wonderful website for finding mods on any radio that you could possibly imagine. Just doing different things, you know, opening up the receive or even the transmit frequencies on it, it's great. But then I bought a lot of junk. I bought a lot of books and, you know, just little knickknacks and stuff. But, we spent quite a bit of money there. But it was well worth it because I got a lot of useful things, which moves me on to my next topic.
Well, before we leave Hamvention here, let me ask a couple questions here. Do they have – I realize that, of course, it's more for hammies, for the hammers. But I don't know if that's an impolite term or not. But do they have much in the way of computers and other electronic stuff there? Because I always thought
that's a good question. I mean, a lot of the smaller ham fest I go to, it's about 2/3 ham radio, 1/3 computers. This particular one, I mean, there was quite a few computer dealers out there, you know, hawking, you know, LCD screens and custom systems and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I noticed and what I've talked to a lot of people. There's a lot less booths this year, or a lot more empty booths, and the people that did leave were the computer people. So, I mean, you can find the computer stuff. A lot of people outside in the swap market were selling, you know, Cisco switches and, any kind of computer product you'd want. I mean, old computers, new computers, whatever you got. I mean, a lot of Cisco products out there, a lot of not enterprise, but medium business-sized networking gear was outside for the taking, so...
I was picturing a lot of old POS point of sale systems and maybe old cash registers from places that have like been liquidated and they're getting rid of all the old stuff.
And there's actually a lot of liquidation out there. There's a lot of power. I mean, just there's a lot of UPSs, a lot of unadulterable power supplies, a lot of just kind of just crap really that would come out of like a junk store or something.
Right, which is sometimes really fun though.
You'll find a lot of things. Like, if you find a use, I mean, if you need a lot of just cables and stuff, you'll find cables dirt cheap. I mean, things that I was looking for were a lot more high-end.
But,
you know, if you just need basic stuff, that's where you go.
Yeah, and that's very good to mention that, I've been to some of the computer-oriented ones, and less from the ham and more the computer, and, like, that's definitely where you get cables, adapters, little things like that you can buy them online. It may cost you a couple bucks plus shipping, or you can go to these places like the Hamventions, et cetera, computer shows local, and you can get them for, 25 cents or, three for a dollar ridiculous.
So, I mean, there's a lot of things there you might go online, you might go to Best Buy, and it might cost you like 20 bucks.
Right.
But, I mean, I saw FireWire cables there and stuff for like $2 or a dollar.
Exactly.
And you don't pay any shipping, and you don't pay any tax. So, right. I mean, it's a steal.
Good stuff. Now, one other question. This really is more of a sales thing. It's made for, like you said, the booths inside with the real vendors and stuff, and then the swap shop type outdoor garage sale type stuff. Do they have or do they offer? Are there any kind of classes / presentations like at a hacking convention?
It's kind of like hope in a way, because they have a lot of the things like, I mean, they have a lot of, like, kind of, well, how would I say it? Like, they have a lot of, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, you know, panel discussion and stuff there.
Do they actually have a schedule?
If you need to take a test, they offer the tests there and stuff, so they have a lot of those things.
Right. I would hope that they offer the tests on location if people wanted to do that. That would be kind of neat. But did they actually have a schedule and a list of presenters and times and stuff, or is it maybe just two or three?
Oh, yeah. The reason the president of the AWRL was there because the AWRL made their kind of convention along with simultaneous at the Dayton convention. It's all worked out. There's a big schedule beforehand, and, you know, you show up to your certain panel on VoIP or your certain panel on satellite work. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff there.
Interesting. And do you have any ballpark numbers of how many people show up to this thing? I know the Dayton one is the biggest.
I had a ticket, and the serial number on my ticket was 10,000. So, I mean, I don't know if 10,000 people showed up, but my serial number was 10,000. So right. There's a lot of people.
We don't know if they started at zero. But, yeah, the Dayton one is the biggest one.
That is definitely the biggest show you could ever go to.
Right. But, however, look in your area. There are local ones. I know there's one in Miami down here. I know they have them in other places. So check out when one's local to you and go check it out.
Yeah, I'll talk about that more. I mean, if you go look online for clubs, for amateur radio clubs in your area, on the AWR website, which I'll link to in the show notes, there's just a search for, you put in your zip code. I think I've mentioned this a lot before. Put in your zip code and tells you all the local AWRL-affiliated clubs. And almost all clubs do a once-a-year Hamfest or twice-a-year Hamfest to raise funding for the club. So you go there and you can find anything you need computer-wise. I guarantee it.
Cool. All right, good stuff. Now, let's move out of the Hamfest stuff, and you wanted to talk about some actual application
stuff.
Yeah, this is
another
one of these things
that I found actually was a little skeptical at first in amateur radio, but I found out that it's been really, really fun. Like, I like the one thing that I really like about amateur radio is the talking to people and very far distances. Like, that's the whole thing with shortwave. But then there's another thing I mentioned before, IRLP, the Internet Radio Linking Project, that's online. You can go to IRLP.net or some of the old episodes. I think the first episode of RFA, if you can find it, not the first episode, first one, but the first one I was on, which is in the 20s, I actually did a little IRLP segment. So we go there and listen to it if you want to get interest sparked. And all the stuff I'll talk about on here is able to be done with the first test that you take. Like the RLP is the first test you take with amateur radio. It's the easiest test and all that stuff. So I wouldn't worry about that too much. And then there's the one thing I want to talk about now is satellite operations and microwave later on. But satellite work, as everyone knows, there's satellite TV these days. They have satellite internet that's extremely expensive and totally a lot of latency on there. So don't buy satellite radio. Don't buy satellite internet unless you really need it. But, I mean, your satellite, your XM, your Sirius radio, I mean, your satellite TVs, you know, your DirecTV, your Dish Network, all that stuff. But there's another thing there, and there's amateur radio satellites. Have you heard of that thing?
You've told me a little bit about it before, but beyond that, I have now done no research on it.
Yeah, so like amateur radio satellites, they're the same thing. They're just satellites that are up there. They're different orbits. Around the planet. I mean, there's no geosynchronous, from what I know and what I've talked to, there's no geosynchronous amateur radio satellite because it's a very expensive place to sit in. That's where all the DirecTV sits in. But it's very expensive to sit there because there's so many that want to be there.
You mean sit there in space?
Yeah, well, geosynchronous, okay, I should explain my terminology. Geosynchronous means it stays in one place. It follows the rotation of the Earth. At all times, so you always have DirecTV.
Right, so
it's a fixed radio.
Right, it's a fixed place in orbit around the Earth that you
can
count on it.
Relative to the Earth, but it goes with the orbit of the Earth.
Right, it goes exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, and also just to clarify, earlier you mentioned RFA, and of course most listeners know that that's Radio Freak America you're referring to, that you can check out at oldschoolfreak.com.
Yeah, there's a lot of links. I don't think they carry all the sites. But there's a lot of mirrors for all of the shows. So search Mute in the House or just search MUT3 on that page, and you'll find me in one of the show notes and listen to that one, that first episode.
Yeah,
it's
actually,
like 23 or 24.
Yeah, we do have all of the shows up and available now, so they should all be there. And we actually relaunched a podcast. And I don't know if we, you've been made aware of that, but we relaunched the podcast.
Oh, yeah, I heard about that. That's pretty cool.
And I think it's up to like maybe 12, 13, 14 episodes now, so it started back over
from
one.
In a few weeks, you'll run into me again.
All right.
So then, okay, so more about this radio thing. So, I mean, so satellites, you know, there's your geosynchronous satellites, and then satellites just orbit the Earth. This is where the amateur radio comes in. So you have your satellite, and just a basic premise of a satellite, there's a problem. Today, I mean, if you have an antenna on the top of your house you transmit on, it only goes so far because there's only so many ways that radio wave will propagate. There's things called ground wave propagation where it just kind of travels along towards the ground, keeping with the ground until, you know, it reaches its point where you hit the problem with the curvature of the Earth. Or there's things called skyway propagation that there's radio waves that bounce off of different parts of the ionosphere of the Earth. There's different bands. If you read on, just search ionosphere of the Earth online, and you'll get a better explanation. But because of the sun, the radio waves can stay within the circle of the sphere of the Earth. They bounce off this kind of almost bouncing off clouds, but they're not clouds, but different rings, and they can bounce off, you know, go around. And that's what makes these high-frequency and HF and short waves so powerful, because you can go all the way around the Earth with them. You can't use HF for everything. You need, you know, more bandwidth and more power. Bandwidth as you need to use more megahertz to transmit more data, because, you know, there's a limit to how much data you can transmit within a certain amount of bandwidth.
Right.
So what they did was they threw these satellites up in the air so that if it's geosynchronous, you could just send data to it and then relay data to everyone else. So there's satellites there's dishes pointed at satellites that send data up to it, and the satellite spits it all back down to the Earth, to America, for instance.
Right.
So there's the same thing. The same principle happens here. There's satellites that orbit the Earth that are they're called amateur radio satellites or OSCARs, operational satellites carrying amateur radio or something like some acronym like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go to, as I said, this will be the site of the night act or site of the week called amsat.org, amsat.org. You go there, you'll find everything you've ever wanted to know about satellites. Mm-hmm. And I'm a member. I just joined. That's the other thing I did. I became a member of that because they do some awesome work. They put the satellites up there. So the thing is, so you have these satellites, right? You get, these satellites are really high up in the air. I mean, some of them, you know, they average, you know, 1,000 meters up there. So, I mean, that's pretty high. So you throw them up there, and you can point a very directional antenna at it. Like, you have the satellite dishes for dish network and all those things. And you point a highly directional antenna at it, and you can send signals to it. So that's what they do with dish network. You pull the signals down with a very directional dish. So what I do was I bought an antenna that's directional for the amateur radio bands, and I pointed my – and then online you can get a program that will tell you the path of the satellite because, I mean, as I said before, these are not geosynchronous, so they kind of follow an arc across the sky. So there's a lot of software out there. Some of it's free. Some of it's pretty expensive, just depending on how cool it looks. But, you know, you can tell exactly where the satellite is going to come over the Earth. And then you point your antenna at it, and then you can talk. So I did this a couple nights ago. I think it was actually a week ago, last Monday night, and I did it. I mean, I had all the, you know, the pattern of it, and I sweeped across, and you know, I heard the satellite. It was amazing. I talked to people on it. But really fun. You don't realize how cool it is until you really do it because, I mean, you're hearing people across the country. Let me just tell you the range. I mean, with a normal amateur radio repeater or something that's local, you can only go so far. I mean, maybe 50 miles. These satellites cover the entire, you know, continent, or even, you know, Mexico and Canada. So you're talking anyone up there that's under the kind of the footprint, or they say, of the satellite at the moment. So it's really cool.
Very good stuff. Now, what kind of equipment do you need to get started on that? Because that is a little bit different than...
That is, yeah. First of all, I mean, for any kind of amateur radio work, you need a decent handheld radio, or, I mean, a decent base station radio. I mean, that's going to be some cost. I mean, that could be $100 or $50, I mean, depending on where you get it from, how much features it has, and then what kind of use it has. I also recommend, you know, getting a scanner, a radio scanner. I mean, that can be bought on eBay pretty nicely. About $50 or $100. You don't need anything fancy. I mean, so you need, you know, you don't need anything new right now. But for these satellites, they operate on different frequencies, so, I mean, you might send on a different frequency and then receive on a completely different frequency, different bands even. I mean, there's the 144 megahertz band, and they might, might receive the frequency in the 440 megahertz band or something like that, so they're wildly different. So, I mean, what I did was, and why I spent so much money, was because I got a nice compact system that, you know, that sends the signal out there and I receive it very well. But you don't spend that much money on it. If you go on that website I said before, they tell you what you need to get. You can do it with a scanner and a cheap radio, maybe $100 to $150 for the entire thing, depending on how well you can work eBay. But you can get it working, and it's amazing.
All right, and you still need a license for this to participate in this as well.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you don't need a license to listen.
Right.
You can get a scanner and listen to amateur radio stuff. I mean, you could spend maybe $100 and just listen to this stuff.
Right, yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point of clarification. It's just the broadcasting.
Yeah, it's just the transmitting.
Or the transmitting, excuse me, right.
Yeah, it's the transmit that costs the money because you're sending it up there. I mean, I had to buy a nice directional antenna that's kind of lightweight. It's meant for, I bought a lot, I always go mobile. I got a lot of stuff that I can be portable with that I don't have to be tied down to. Because, the tied down stuff costs a lot more money. I mean, I bought that thing so I can be around, I can go around with it, I can show people stuff, so, yeah.
Very cool, very cool. All right, well, we are pretty much full for the show. We've got a little bit of time if you wanted to touch on anything else.
Yeah, I just want to mention to everyone, if you're still interested in amateur radio, and I was going to tell Stink this, I'll link you to the website to tell you where amateur radio, you know, clubs are at, but the other thing is you should check out the last day of this month. There is, next month, last weekend in June, is always Amateur Radio Field Day, which
right.
is this big thing. It's 24 hours long. It's meant to mirror a emergency communication thing, where I mean, if there is a big something bad happens, you need amateur radio quickly. This is what it's for. It's a big contest. Everyone gets on the air. Everyone operates, you know, they kind of like an emergency power or anything, and they make as many contacts as possible within 24 hours. So, and usually there's always demo sites, so you can go and actually do amateur radio right there. You don't need a license because of the rules of how it works. As long as someone's there that has a license, you can operate.
Right.
So you should go. I mean, they have demos. They're always about getting new members. So I'll link it later on tonight, but I'll show you where it's very easy to, you know, get there and get involved very quickly.
All right. Yeah, great. You got a lot of good links that you're going to send me, and we'll put them up in the show notes as soon as possible.
Yep.
And I guess the biggest one in our official site of the week, as you said earlier, is amsat.org. That's AMSAT.org, which is all the information about the satellites that Mute was just talking about there.
Yeah, and I mean, they just search amateur radio satellites. I mean, I got very interested. I've collected about 5 or 6 bookmarks and about 10 downloaded about 10 pages about all this stuff. I mean, it's very experimental. I mean, a lot of people, maybe not experimental in that it's new, but I mean, experimental in that a lot of people, it's very easy to work with because, I mean, the stuff really, once you get into the microwave, as I said before, it's not that expensive. I mean, it's actually kind of come full circle. I mean, back when, you know, as a kid, you know, playing with the wireless and 802.11b and, you know, building all that stuff, it would come to a full circle where I'm coming back up to commercial grade stuff. So, I mean, pretty interesting.
Yep. Yep, good stuff. All right, well, let's start closing it out this week. We did the site of the week already. Remind everybody that we have 2600 meetings coming up this week. I know that you've been kind of focusing on college and stuff like that. Do you ever attend anymore at all?
When I'm in Chicago, I always go, as long as the schedule permits me, and I love it. I mean, we kind of moved places. We've been to a better place now, not a bar anymore, but a better place to have computers and internet access, but it's tons of fun. Always go. That's why I got started in all this stuff. You know, if you can go, do it. It's
great. So even Mute here, who's unplugged from a lot of other things to concentrate on college and whatnot, still finds a day out of each month, or as many as he can anyway, to go to his 2600 meetings, and I think everybody else should be able to do the same, to go to a whatever, whether it's 2600 meeting, a DEF CON meeting, again, a BenRev meeting, whatever you want to call it, whatever you want to go to. This week is 2600 meeting, so, you know, go check one out. Look it up, do a search, find whatever your local area, do a search for your state in 2600 and see if you can find something, see if they're active, see where they're meeting, and go check it out. And shouts. Why don't you start us off with shouts this week? You got any shout-outs?
All right. Yeah, I got some shouts. I got shout-out to my best friend, E, to the ARRL AMSET, the site that the music comes from today, OpSound, and the software that I never mentioned the software before, the satellite stuff. There's a piece of software, it's free, it's actually included, I think it's actually standard on Debian. It's called Predict, P-R-E-D-I-C-T. It's text-based, you just type it in the command line, and it will give you all, if you set up your latitude and longitude correctly, you can get that stuff online. I'll link that to how to, if you just, as long as you know what city you live in, you can get your latitude, longitude, and your elevation very easily. And you can actually tell, they'll actually tell you where the satellites are coming from and passes, and I can pass some more links on, where you can actually plug all that data into a program that will plot it for you, and you can actually see it in, like, all in pseudo-real time. So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'm glad you remembered to mention the software. My shouts this week go to Bland Inquisitor. I spoke to him the other day, and he's doing very well. CypherX, to Mr. VTech, and to anyone and everyone who's listening to Binary Revolution Radio while you're at work. You know, I know a lot of people do that. I've done that. I listen to most shows while I'm at work and coding. I'm in my headphones while everyone around me drones and buzzes around doing their thing and listening to music or whatever, and I'm trying to multitask and educate myself by listening to talk radio and listening to online talk radio and coding, et cetera, et cetera. So I hope we help you all make it through the day. I know it's very beneficial to me as a listener to do that. And, of course, this is Monday that we're recording this. You're hearing this on Tuesday, so it's probably a day late when you hear this. But, you know, I have to give shouts out, and I do this every year, and I always have and always will, to all the veterans out there. This is Memorial Day, and I give shouts and thanks, genuine thanks to everyone out there, because people that are out there doing this and the veterans out there, they're the reason that I have the freedom to do this show. Every week, week in and week out, they're the people that have given me the ability and given me the freedom to do this show. So the biggest shouts of all to them. Happy Memorial Day, and thank you sincerely for that. And email, if you want to email us about anything we've talked about on the show, the email address is radio@binrev.com. And our closing music, mentioned a minute ago, is Alcorine, A-L-C-O-R-I-N-E, and it's called Precinct 1. And that is going to do it. So, Wintermute, I'm glad we were able to catch up, first of all. I mean, it took almost 100 episodes. No, I guess it took about 75 episodes or somewhereabouts before we were able to get it back together again. But it was definitely for the right reasons. You're out there bringing home those A's, except for one.
One, yeah, super writing class.
But doing good stuff for us, and we're very proud that you're doing that. And, of course, you do pop in once in a while, whenever the forums are working, that is.
Yeah,
and,
right.
So we're keeping in touch, and we still hear from you and talk to you occasionally. So good to have you back on the show again. And I think that is going to do it for episode 98 of Binary Revolution Radio. So we tell everybody, Wintermute, how do we end the show now? I'll let you start at this time since it's been so long.
All right, so, you know, we'll see you next week on the same hack time.
And the same hack channel. We'll be right back.
Bandcamp, let us know if you're listening to this call.